Alistair Duncan, Strategic Industry Lead for the Service and Food Workers Union, Aotearoa Tauhara. I want to thank my colleagues and those that sit with me, and I want to thank the members of the committee who, from your body language, are listening. When we constructed with NZNO and Service and Food Workers Union the charter, we didn't think that the word charter would have quite the political focus that it does. Charter schools are very much the order of the conversation among our sister unions, the PPTA and the NZEI. I put it to you that today we have charter care. We have a public-private partnership in which increasingly multinationals, equity firms and offshore-controlled businesses are banking on the largest growth sector in this economy. It is not dairy, it is not tourism, it is not forestry, and it is not litigation. It is the care and support of the elderly. And so when we constructed our four asks of the state as the funder, we did so understanding that the future was already before us. You know the demographics. I look at the committee, you are that demographic. Sorry about that. And look at the workforce. The workforce is also an ageing workforce. These working women have waited for decades for fairness. And every year they've waited, they have continued to deliver that care. This charter on its own provides some of the answers. In the interim, you have also received a series of other reports. The Grant Thornton report brings very clearly the reasons that we are corporatising aged care. The corporates are here to make a return on investment. We say good luck to them. That's fine. But while it's underpinned by the public money, we need the transparency, we need the training, we need the fair pay, and we need the safe staffing that my colleagues have talked about. This is public money. This is the public forum to have that conversation. Since Grant Thornton, you've also seen the work produced by the Labor Green team in the last 12 months, and you might say that's a bit partisan. Look, it was no more partisan than the Grant Thornton report that simply didn't talk to the workforce. So there's two conflicting documents actually saying some of the same things. And usefully this year you have Dr. Judy McGregor's report, Caring Counts. In this committee, you don't need to come up with the answers. The answers are there, researched, identified, and the invitation sits with you as a committee, but also with you as representatives of the parties that form the constituency of Parliament. We invite you to take on those recommendations. We invite you to celebrate them and to apply the decency of not just listening today, but acting. We've also taken the opportunity, because this is a trade union presentation and we're just about as organised as the front bench of the National Party, to put forward some recommendations to you. They're not revolutionary. They don't seek to overthrow the rights of employers, the responsibilities of staff and the care and compassion of New Zealand. We recommend that the 2005 safe staffing indicators are updated and are made mandatory. Look at the hoo-ha that's going on at the moment about the proposals to change motor vehicle testing. Why wouldn't we have a warrant of fitness and aged care? We request that there be an urgent review conducted of this unregulated workforce. You've heard about the proliferation of qualifications amongst industry training organisations. Other than the notional presence of a registered nurse at the end of a telephone, there is no control on the care delivered to our parents and our grandparents and the increasing number of people in facilities with respite care. And lastly, because we come with the pride and dignity of trade unions, asking for the respect that the workforce deserved, we need to address the pay gap. It's no coincidence that there is a case filed by my union testing the 1972 Equal Pay Act. It has the potential to be larger than the recent sleepover settlement. But we don't want this matter to be resolved in confrontation and litigation. This is the most passive workforce in New Zealand. And yet they are saying, be fair to those who care. We really appreciate your time today. We really appreciate the energy with which you're listening. We welcome your questions. And we leave you with the invitation to actually respond. The tsunami of care is upon us now. Let's do the right thing. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We've got about 35 minutes for questions, so I'll open up to the members. Thank you very much, Kia ora koutou, and welcome to the Select Committee. Thank you very much, all of you, for your contributions this morning. They have been brief and to the point. Your points have been well covered, and they have been well substantiated, as you say, by a number of reports. And so it is about action, and I welcome the recommendations several things in order. If I just correct me if I haven't got you right. But first of all, fair pay. Secondly, training and recognition across the board, recognition for additional skills gain and remuneration for that. And then thirdly, some safe staffing provisions. Is that the top three? Have I got that clear?
Okay. That and the transparency on the funding in terms of your contract with DHBs.
Absolutely. Of course, you'll be aware that that in the days of the last government, when we did put some money across, you'd be aware that it didn't make it through. And that's been an ongoing argument that I certainly, for one, have with Martin Taylor of the association. And so that is something that I still think was wrong, and I do hold them to account. An additional note, those of you who work in the top of the south, in the Nelson region, Ryman is the second largest participant in the building and construction industry in Nelson, Tasman. So you would think that that they were well equipped to return to their investors and pay equal pay at the very least. So I just wanted to check that I've got the three priorities right, which I understand.
Thank you, and
the transparency as well. And thank you for being here today, Andrew.
Thanks, Chief. It was a nice whole flight to hear the account about the training and the qualifications. I understood what you said. Those three big retirement home providers, Ryan, Google, and Oceana, all have their own in-house training systems. Can I just clarify, are those linked to the National Qualifications Framework?
There's a Byzantine link back through the hook on the NZQA, but what it means is, Andrew, that the opportunities for the workforce to achieve consistency in delivery are absolutely very different.
And did I hear you right, the ITO, rather than ITO, is not involved in determining...
The ITO is Career Force, so to give credit, for example, to Bupa, it's the single largest consumer of the Career Force qualifications, and it is working with the Health Education Trust, the offshoot of Ryman Care, to try and put in some consistency. Unlike Oceania, who went off to Taipotene Polytechnic on the West Coast, not to bash the West Coast of the South Island, but it wasn't exactly the cutting edge of aged care. Great on mineral development.
Something else on there. Are you aware that the NZQA is requiring relevance in these plethora of qualifications across the board? I mean, there's a huge number of hairdressing. I mean, it's not just aged care. Are you aware that work has been going on in that area?
Certainly we're closely involved in TROC, the Targeted Review of Qualifications, to boil that down. Mm. But, Cam, this is the point. If there is not a requirement for consistency, most of these employers will not invest the time and resources to deliver. It's about regulating an unregulated workforce. And many of you will remember the debates in early childhood. At that end of the spectrum, we have standards. At my increasing age, at this end of the spectrum, I want to know the staff who are looking after me are cared and supported. That's a fair point you make.
David?
Is it generally true, and there'll obviously be exceptions, that the not-for-profit sector are paying a higher wage rate than the for-profit sector?
Yes, that is generally true.
So is there an as-yet unresolved conflict between returns on capital and returns on labour in the healthcare
sector.
It's not only unresolved, it's being exacerbated. And I think the points that were made by Marion Street about the housing and construction boom that Ryman is driving is that these companies will invest in bricks and mortar, and good luck to them. But think about the capital asset that builds, about the equity base. It's no coincidence that our large providers are either trading on the local or the international equity markets.
And in terms of the reports that you've put forward to us today, which one would you encourage me to read most to try and get my head around how we resolve that tension? Obviously there needs to be an adequate return on capital, but there doesn't need to be an excessive return on capital at the cost of labour.
I think you have a close look at the EEO Commissioner's report and you go back to the Grant Thornton report, and yes, it's 2.5 years old now, that recommended a 9% return on investment. And you ask yourself, is that fair in this economy?
David's actually preempted a lot of questions that you're going to ask, but can I first of all say thank you very much for the work that you do do and the impassioned submission that you've given to this committee. We were listening and we are seriously looking at the issue that you've raised with us. The question is, I guess, why is there an exodus of the religious based, if you like, or even community based non profit organisations from this sector, and an increase in the number of for-profit multinationals, as you've described them, into the sector? It makes no sense that our church-based and other community-based groups would not still be, I guess, at the forefront in the sector and still providing the very high level of care that they have over the many years that they've been involved.
I think it makes sense if you have a look at Paula O'Reilly's example. Paula was working for Oceania. Some years ago they purchased the Norman Kirk rest home. Look, the place was run down. The place had a photo of the Queen before her kids went off the rails. But it was somewhere that you walked into that was full of love and compassion. But it didn't have en-suites. It didn't have a swimming pool. It didn't have a fish tank. Contrast those religious and welfare, old, loving, but tired facilities with the enormous capital to development. Go and have a look at Malvina Major, the old Burma Lodge at the top of the hill. That's the standard that's being set. That's the standard that correctly public funding underpins. So those enormous developmental costs, the religious and welfare groups have not been able to sustain. And so the private operators have come in, underpinned, knowing that the wage bill is guaranteed. Imagine if we applied that across the tourism and hospitality sector. Everyone who walks into Sky City, underpinned by the taxpayer, you know the cost of that.
But I think that cosmetic and superficial building, the money that's gone into buildings to make them look like Melbourne Major, has been the detriment of the care and the care provided and the not just the pay rate, but also the actual care of old people. Mm.
Right. I mean, you did alarm me with the suggestion of the type of return on investment that some of these guys are expecting. Mm. I see it right across the private sector as well as the state sector. You know, if they are achieving those types of returns, then clearly someone's going to pay the bill.
Do you have any idea of the sort of interest rate these companies will be paying on commercial loans?
Well, if you have a look, for example, at Bupa, it's linked back through its largest British UK insurance provider. It's very difficult to find out. You can have a look at those that are publicly traded, so the Somerset Group, the MetLife Care Group, the Ryman Group. You can have a look at their accounts and try and extrapolate. No coincidence that MetLife has just recently purchased its competition. But then you also need to understand the funding mechanisms of somebody like Oceania. Oceania, an offshore private equity firm, they own two very interesting things. They run wind farms in France, and from a union point of view, they run the Gdansk shipyards in Poland. Their ability to leverage off each other. I'm saying if you have a look at their accounts, you'll find the answer.
I'm asking you, do you have any evidence of the interest rates these people are paying on commercial loans available in New Zealand? And the answer to that is yes or no.
The answer is that if you have a look at their accounts, you will get understanding. I'm not here for cross-examination, thank you, John.
Well, I can tell you you're going to be paying somewhere in the range of 7-12%.
Yeah.
So if you're paying 12%, 9% return on capital is not hugely wonderful.
No, but if you're building a base, and if you look at that tsunami of aged care, pay 12% now with a view to having the market share in the future of an expanding product then you'd be very happy to pay over the market now.
Do you consider your staff to be in a market?
Oh, I don't consider that it should be a market, but by heck it is. Why are these companies listed on the stock exchange if they're not in the market?
No, but as an employee saying, why fuck around, I thought I had a tour, or in Masterton, are your unit members having to compete for work in a market amongst limited suppliers?
In some areas, yes.
And does that impact on the rates that they get offered?
Yes, one of our delegates who isn't with us today has just recently left an Oceania facility in Whitianga because she could get better pay at Pack and Save.
Thank you. Next question, Barbara.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I wondered whether or not there was general agreement within the industry on what safe staffing levels are, and how difficult would it be to come to some agreement?
I think there is debate in the industry about how those safe staffing levels are provided. I used the example with the demise of the Old People's Home regulations in 2005. It's sufficient that there is a nurse available at the end of a telephone. We'd like somebody on the floor.
Well, it's on that very moment. I was interested in your comment about the age-related residential care services agreement between DHBs and aged care residential facilities. Has safety obligations in that? Could you comment upon how effective they are? I was a bit concerned, and thank you for your testimony from everyone, that some of you thought there was a problem with safety as a result of staffing levels. But according to the information, I was just wondering, one would expect that to be covered by this agreement. Is that not working?
The National Art contract is 4 pages, double-spaced with an inch and a half margin down the side. It is a purchase agreement for a service. The quality of that service is largely silent.
Well, are you saying it doesn't include safety obligations designed to maximise the effectiveness?
It doesn't spell out staffing ratio. It's left to the employer to decide upon those. And the 2005 indicators for safe staffing were, as Alistair says, nominal, and they're now 6 or 7 years out of date. I would say actually that in nursing there would be agreement on safe staffing levels, but the discussion has never taken place. There's not been a review of those 2005 indicators.
Just a final question, but does it not require an obligation on behalf of the service provider, in other words the home owners, to provide sufficient staff to ensure safe care of those residents within that facility?
I think certainly in generic terms it says they must provide safe care, but what the nature of that safe care or staffing ratios or numbers of nurses per resident, like Lynn has 65 residents at her home, she's one registered nurse to 65 residents in both hospital and rest home level care, I wouldn't call that safe personally.
Final question, do you think that the increased level of audit that's taking place now of the residential facilities is likely to identify areas where that safety level is not high enough and thereby lead to a solution being found? Is that likely to address some of your concerns?
I'm not sure that that's actually part of their role that they have to. You could easily carry out a DHB audit or from your contractor company and not address safe staffing. You can talk to auditors go around and talk to staff about whether or not they feel it's safe, but there is actually, they could come away from there not recommending it to be more staff, but in fact that the infection control rates are poor or are very good, but not necessarily about safe staffing. It's quite a nebulous concept, and it's been allowed to be nebulous because it hasn't been concrete and it hasn't actually identified how many nurses should be looking after a certain number of residents.
Thank you. You haven't asked a question.
Can I just have one follow-up on those? I'm going to ask. Are there differences between the DHB establishments and the private establishments with staffing levels?
Yes, the DHBs are absolutely cross the T and dot the I.
I guess my question would be related to that. In fact, I'll choose that one area. Is there a difference in the skill component of the role of any of the occupations that we're talking about here between the aged care sector and DHBs that might justify different pay rates and conditions.
Tactfully, we would say that healthcare assistants are healthcare assistants are healthcare assistants. Practically, our colleagues in the private sector will engage in a range of intimate care duties over a longer time, build closer relationships, and in fact is often the practice in the DHB.
I thought I knew the answer to that question.
For example, Kevin, though, for example, administering medications, caregivers or unregulated staff, HCAs, whatever you want to call them, certainly would not be giving up medication. It's always been seen as a nursing task. But in aged care sector, they now are required to do that sort of thing.
It's become
the
norm.
Other things besides.
Thank you very much.
Well,
I appreciate
thank you very much for your presentation today. And we will now ask you to speak, and we'll ask the Minister to come forward.